units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
Scotty's on fire.
Scott, I've missed you so much. You've been playing hard to get lately.
Well, yeah, I've been off enjoying the sights and sounds and experiences of Russia.
All right. And now you're in. I've been trying to get the pronunciation, and of course I forgot about it after I worked on it for about an hour. Yekaterinburg, is that how to say it?
Yekaterinburg, yep. Previously known as
Yekaterinburg. Yekaterinburg. Yekaterinburg.
Yekaterinburg. Previously what?
Previously known as Sverdlovsk.
Oh, please.
It had a name even prior to that.
What's the point of making it even more difficult?
That's the point.
Oh, all right. And Scott's having computer problems, but being the resourceful Marine that he is, he quickly switched to Plan B, and we're getting a pretty good connection on your phone. Not bad at all.
Yeah, no, the Wi-Fi in Russia is quite good. The internet is too when my computer cooperates. So
this is a computer problem, not an internet problem. Okay, so don't blame it on Russia. All you Russophobes, don't blame it on Russia. This is a computer problem.
It's purely operator error or whatever I'm doing, but my keyboard stopped working, couldn't type in my password. The mouse works, everything works, but every time I pushed a button on the keyboard, nothing happened.
All right, so let's go over some of the latest highlights, and then we'll get to questions from the audience. We've got a big backlog of questions. Everybody's hungering for your commentary about this and that. We just had Victory Day. You weren't at Victory Day itself, but you went to rehearsal. That was a tricky security move, right?
Well, it's also an access move. I mean, to be honest, as of May 7th, as of May 7th, the Russian government hadn't signed the final order for May 9th because of security concerns. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is the day of the Victory Day parade on May 9th, Ukraine sent 3 drones against Moscow. They were all shot down by Russian air defense. But, you know, to anybody who thinks that the Russians are being paranoid and such about security, no, Moscow was attacked on Victory Day. So the decision was that if I was going to have an opportunity to see the parade, to go ahead and see the full-scale rehearsal on May 7th, which it's the full parade. I mean, President Putin wasn't there. He didn't give his address. But as you can see,
I was going to say, for a rehearsal, it looks like an awfully elaborate affair and a lot of people there.
Oh, no. First of all, it's very difficult to get tickets to this. The stands were full of special invited guests, and it's, you know, to be able to get a ticket to the show was amazing. And it was the real deal. They did everything, the emotion of the soldiers, the emotion of the audience, everything was genuine. This was, you know, if you couldn't be at the actual parade, this was the next best thing.
So what'd you do? You slipped a C note into the hand of the usher or something to get in?
Oh God, no. They locked down the center of Moscow. I think I went through easily a dozen security checkpoints. They had snipers up on the roof. They had guys with drone guns walking around. They had dogs. Mm-hmm. They checked everything. And I'm pretty sure I was the only American there. The surprise of some of the security guards when I handed them my American passport was obvious. They were like, what the hell do we do with this American? They had to call in their colonels, and then they realized that I actually had a ticket and was invited, and I got it with no problem. Look,
well, weren't you with somebody of an official nature, or were you just by yourself?
Oh, no. I'm always with somebody of an official nature, and the gentleman rapidly resolve the issue. So,
and who took this video? Was this you or Vika?
No, this is me. Unfortunately, Vika on this day, she's still completing her schoolwork, so she had to miss this opportunity and get an assignment done.
I see. Well, priorities. So cinematography by our favorite weapons inspector.
Well, there you go. I tell you again, there's a, I don't know if I sent it to you. There was a clip, right before the Russian national anthem plays, and you hear the soldiers, you know, shout out, "Hoorah!" And they, I mean, to hear thousands of,
Russians. Yeah, that was in there, but I mean, I'm killing the volume so that you can talk over.
No, but I mean, I think people should hear that. That's, that's a spectacular moment.
I don't know how to find it though. That's the only thing. We'll have to, we can get that for the next episode or something. And what's this all about?
I had an opportunity to speak at the Writers Union, and I, of course, proudly exclaimed my heritage as being a Marine. And the director said, "Well, he's a paratrooper." And I said, "Well, we're going to have to settle this man to man." And he put his arm up first. So,
all right. So it's much like your duel with Ryan Milton. It's not really clear who won. Is that how? I think that's how it always goes, huh?
I think what we both agreed is that I wasn't going to let him beat me on camera. Just like I agreed with Ryan that I wasn't going to let him beat me on camera. So went through the act and it made it look like I could hold my own. But
all right. Well, thank you for making time for us. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure our audience does too. I know that it's been a very busy time for you. A lot of people are clamoring for your attention. So we don't.
I have to tell you, we spent a couple days in Moscow, and I actually thought there would be some downtime and some free time, and all. There was no free time. I mean, this is wonderful. Don't get me wrong. I love every second of this. This is. But anybody who thinks that I'm here on a grand vacation, this is work. I mean, I'm working. in some cases, 12. 14, 16 hour days.
But as compared to the US when you work 12, 14, 16 hours.
That's my whole point. People are like, "Oh, you're going to go to Russia. You can have a rest. You can have a relax." First of all, it is very relaxing. The people are just unbelievably kind here. Unbelievable. I mean, I haven't had a bad experience yet. Everybody's just overwhelmingly kind.
You're still being recognized by a lot of people?
Yeah, that's a little uncomfortable to be walking down the streets or in the metro, and all of a sudden everybody wants to come up and shake your hand. I don't want to say this to get anybody the wrong impression, but you know how, you know, Hollywood stars gets, you know, can't go out in public.
Right. Yeah, it's giving you a taste of that, right?
Well, it is, and the people with me are like, you know, this is good, but this is why we have to have security with you too, because you know you are easily recognizable. And while we have no issue with good people coming up and shaking your hand, you said, you know, there's a lot of bad people out there too. And
yeah,
you
know, right.
You got to be careful.
Right. All right. Well, let's get to the questions from our beloved audience. And thanks for your patience, everybody, and for understanding that we can't really keep to a regular schedule. No, Ryan, I'm not going to use the other wine cup. At least not this evening. It has its time and place. So anyway, it was a great gift, but no need to limit it. All right, let's go to Desolation Row. I bet you can guess who that is from.
That's Mr. Bob Dylan.
Well, yes, but I mean, you know who among our regular audience members is Bob Dylan aficionado. NM, how do you suspect the British government's game of Russian roulette is going to go? It seems like they are counting on there being no bullet.
I think what he's referring to is the most recent decision by the British government to provide Storm Shadow, I think is the name of a long-range cruise missile, to Ukraine. That, in theory, not only gives Ukraine the ability to strike Crimea, but also deeper into Russia. You know, the Russian government will do what it does. I'm not in it. I don't advise it. I wouldn't advise it. What I will say is this. They've been masters at escalation management, meaning they understand what their goals and objectives are, and they're not going to allow NATO, the British, or anybody else to compel them into doing something precipitous that would give NATO an excuse to expand this conflict. So the other thing too is I don't think people understand how advanced the Russians are in terms of their military capabilities. I mean, the West is finally catching up on it. For instance, HIMARS, this highly mobile artillery rocket system that was supposed to be the game changer of the war. You know, Russia's solved it. They've adapted tactically to remove targets of opportunity, and then they've deployed capabilities to shoot down. The vast majority of the HIMARS rockets that are shot are shot fired by the Ukrainians, or either shot down by the Russians or jammed by the Russians so that they go stupid and they don't go to where they're supposed to go. The yes, one or two get through, and there's tragic consequences for that. This is war. It's even more tragic when the Ukrainians fire them on civilian targets, and I don't think the American audience understands that every day the Ukrainians are deliberately attacking civilian targets where there's zero military, there's no military equipment there, nothing going on. They're attacking markets, they're attacking schools, they're attacking hospitals, and these are deliberate targets. They're firing weapon systems that are of high precision. They're receiving intelligence from the United States about the targets in the areas, and they're deliberately picking targets that are of civilian nature, because from the Ukrainian perspective, while the Russians call this a special military operation, the Ukrainian government views Donetsk and Luhansk as breakaway separatists. They call them terrorists. This is part of an extension of what they call an anti-terrorist operation. And so they view all the citizens of Luhansk and Donetsk, of the Donbass, as terrorists. And so they're striking them indiscriminately. It's a huge breach of international law, of the laws of war. But you don't see the International Criminal Court demanding, to put Zelensky in prison. He's a true war criminal, and so is Zaluzhny, and so is every Ukrainian official involved in the ongoing targeting of Russian civilians in this area. But that's just part of the West's hypocrisy.
Odious
behavior.
Foo from Chicago, what's your view of Chaz Freeman? He thinks a war between the U.S. and China over Taiwan is likely, but also thinks Taiwan will end up as another Vietnam or Afghanistan for the U.S.
Well, first of all, I know Chaz Freeman. I respect Chaz Freeman. He was the ambassador to Saudi Arabia when I was involved in Desert Storm. And he and I are both on the advisory board of energy intelligence, and we just did a board meeting before I left for Russia. I have the highest regard for his analysis. If he thinks that there's a war between the U.S. and China likely, I would not discount that possibility. I'd like to believe that the Chinese understand that's not in anybody's best interest, and so I don't think the Chinese are pushing for a war. I think what Chaz Freeman is doing is looking at the inadequacies of U.S. policy, the inconsistencies of U.S. policy, and the over-reliance by the U.S. on military means to implement its China policy. And I think he's discouraged by this, meaning that he sees the probable outcome being war. I agree with just about everything. My only wild card I'd throw in there is that there's an election in November of 2024 in Taiwan, where the opposition party, Kuomintang Party, is more than likely to win the national election, and they are more inclined to seek a peaceful resolution to this issue with China than the current government. So, the United States is doubling down on stupid in terms of continuing to support the Taiwanese government in a manner that makes it appear that they are seeking de facto independence from China. If they win the election and continue to go down this route, then I think war is inevitable. And what Chaz Freeman says is that this won't end well. The United States will be trapped in a conflict it can't win, like Vietnam, like Afghanistan, and ultimately we will be compelled to depart the area, leaving behind a destroyed nation like Ukraine.
Our next question comes from a Happy Rusky in Novosibirsk. I think that might be close to the correct pronunciation. I hope so. How is depleted uranium going to be cleaned up in the world's breadbasket of Ukraine? They already got Chernobyl. Ukraine does not need this, and I can't see a solution to curing the contamination.
No, unfortunately, once like any, you know, toxic dust, because that's what we're talking about here, the depleted uranium that's in the anti-tank round that's been provided by the United Kingdom to the Ukrainian military that's being used in the Challenger 2 tanks. First of all, the Challenger 2 tanks haven't been engaged in combat operations, so to the best of my knowledge, no rounds have been fired as of yet. The other good news is there, I think there's only 14 Challenger 2 tanks, and their survivability on the battlefield is nil. So once they get engaged, they'll be destroyed. As the Russians like to remind everybody, the Challenger 2 burns just as well as any other Ukrainian tank. They're ready to confront this system and destroy it. But if it fires a depleted uranium round and it hits a target, then the depleted uranium will vaporize. It'll be turned into dust particles. And those dust particles will contaminate the air and soil in the area. And I mean, the only way to you know, rectify that situation is to literally scrape the soil into barrels and treat it as hazardous waste. The good news is there's only 14 tanks, so there's a limited amount of ammunition that they can fire. The bad news is once they fire it, the contamination's there forever unless it's mitigated again by physical removal. So you know, that's the problem. That's why depleted uranium should not be allowed to be used as a weapon, and shame on the United Kingdom for providing these shells to the Ukrainians.
That phrase escalation management has been coming up lately. Axel O in Finland asks, when does escalation management turn into just being a bitch to the West?
When you lose. I mean, you know, if you escalation management yourself into defeat, then you're the West's bitch, if that's the term you want to use. But the only person getting bitch slapped around here is Zelensky and the Ukrainians. So, you know, escalation management's the smartest thing in the world. The Russians, you know, they have their eye on the ball. Remember, before this war started, all Russia wanted was a new European. Actually, all Russia wanted was peace with Ukraine. That's what the Minsk Accord was. 8 years, they asked the West, they asked Ukraine, all you have to do is implement Minsk, which they had promised to do when they signed it. So Russia wanted peace. If you want to call that being someone's bitch, that's your opinion. I think that's called sound practice. Although today, you know, Putin has said that his great mistake was not in 2014, not ending this, you know, he had around 10,000 Ukrainian troops surrounded. He could have killed them all, but he chose to go down the path towards peace. For 8 years, they tried. Even when Minsk collapsed in the fall of 2021, the Russians followed through with draft peace treaties, asking NATO and the West, United States, to come up with a new European security framework that would bring stability to the region. The West ignored him. Then he invaded. He sought to minimize the loss. The special military operation was designed to bring Ukraine to the peace table early on. It's almost succeeded. Three immediate meetings in Gomel, Russia, Belarus, and then the final meeting in Istanbul on 1 April that would have brought an end to this conflict. And people should reflect on that. Russia was trying to bring an early end to this conflict, a conflict it didn't want, a conflict it tried to avoid. It was the West that walked away from that table. And as a result, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians are dead. Tens of millions of Ukrainians are displaced, and $1 trillion worth of Ukrainian infrastructure has been destroyed. The only bitch here is Zelensky. The only bitch here is the West. Russia's not trying to, didn't want this war. They're not trying to escalate this war. Russia's keeping this war under control. So they're not overreacting to the numerous, provocations that have been perpetrated by Ukraine and the West. The most recent provocation, of course, being the provision of Storm Shadow by the British.
All right. That question included some very salty language for 6 a.m. in the morning, which is what time it is for you. I think this is the earliest we've seen you.
Well, good morning, Russia.
It's going to take a couple of more cups of coffee before Scotty's on fire, I think, huh?
Don't worry. You can ignite me if you say the right things.
All right. Well, I don't like to be contrived about it. I like it to happen organically, you know. Clyde Ashley from New Orleans, Louisiana. Have you seen or heard of all the Russian war trophies that are being sold on eBay? I would love to hear your opinion of these atrocities being sold for hundreds of dollars. I can't find anything being sold of dead Ukrainians.
I've heard about this. I mean, I think he might be talking about actual body parts, and not just souvenirs. It's disgusting. It's criminal. The fact that the Ukrainian government allows it to happen just underscores the fact that this is a brutal Nazi regime. And I think Americans need to wake up to the fact that, hey, guys, we're fighting on the side of the bad guys. We're fighting on the side of the Nazis, and they are perpetrating horrific crimes. These are, you know, there's some bad people out there. There's some good people out there, too. I mean, I think, you know, one of the sentiments that exists here in Russia is a recognition that this is more of a civil war. When it's Russian against Ukraine, it's a civil war, and they're not happy about this. You know, in early on in World War II, there was a private who was surrounded by the Germans, and they were shouting on him to surrender. And he shouted out, Russians don't surrender. And then he fought to the death. He was the first person to be awarded the hero of the Soviet Union, 21-year-old private. Russians don't surrender. There was, Wagner tells a story of how they surrounded a group of Ukrainian soldiers in Bakhmut. And they shouted in, brothers, surrender, surrender, save your lives. And the Ukrainian soldiers shouted back, Russians don't surrender. And they fought to the death. And that's the horrific reality of this conflict, that it is brother against brother, cousin against cousin. It's also a struggle against the collective West. But, The West is, of course, providing thousands, tens of thousands of mercenaries who are fighting on the side, and then, of course, billions of dollars worth of military equipment. But at the end of the day, there's no Russian that I've ever met that gloats over the fact that Russian soldiers are killing Ukrainians in an overwhelming, casualty ratios. It doesn't make anybody happy. Their hearts are all broken. This is a horribly tragic war.
Well, I don't know what's more disgusting, selling body parts or buying body parts.
They're both disgusting. Anybody who participates in that action should be treated as the criminal they are.
Yeah. Medi T from Toronto, Ontario. What is the main purpose of the U.S. government trying to take away the guns from people? What is the probability of another civil war in America or the people against the U.S. government?
Ooh, another Second Amendment question. look. I'm somebody who believes in the Constitution of the United States of America. I'm somebody who believes that, we should uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. But I am not going to sit here and be a proponent for armed conflict against the government of the United States. Any problems that exist in the United States, and there are many, must be resolved constitutionally, which means that the ideal method is at the ballot box. Anybody says, well, we can't win it, but do better. Okay, do better. The fact that you're sitting there, we can't win, means you're not doing enough. If you are unhappy, organize, get out there, win enough votes. That's how democracy in this constitutional republic works. Get more votes. Get better people. I don't like the people running. Then run yourself. Find someone else out there. Do something. Get off your ass and work. Democracy is hard work. It's not meant to be easy. Everybody wants the easy solution. Go to the election booth, push a button, get somebody in there, magic occurs. That's not how this works, guys. This is hard work. It requires citizen engagement. Government of the people, by the people, for the people doesn't work if the people don't work. Right now, the American people aren't working. They're looking for an easy solution. Is the government trying to take guns away from Americans? No. I think there's a big concern right now in America about gun violence, and people are struggling to come up with a solution. And sometimes they... one side says, that overreacts, the other side underreacts. It's a political problem. and we need to resolve it politically. Stop talking about civil war. I mean, I'm concerned about it as anybody else. You take a look at what's going on, the divisions that exist in the United States. It's unhealthy. But the
Well, you're a student of history, Scott. I think people who talk about civil war are just they don't necessarily have a perspective of how bad things have been in the past. So they see something as bad now, they feel that, and they go, oh, we're on the brink of a civil war. As a historian, are we really on the brink of a civil war? I mean, I understand what you are advocating or not advocating, but just in terms of what, you know, what might be brewing among the populace, it seems to me like it's no worse than it's been in past years.
No, America's all, America, according to this standard, America's always been on the brink of a civil war.
Yeah.
Because I like when people say, it's never been this bad. Well, I've only been around for 61 years, so I can't talk about never. And, some of that 61 years was as a child, meaning that I wasn't cognizant of flu. But, I look at, movies and documentaries and the newsreels of what was going on in the 60s.
That was a very tumultuous decade.
When you had U.S. soldiers in the streets in Detroit, literally engaging in combat operations against American citizens, that was pretty bad. Yeah. Kent State Massacre, we can go on and on. So, we're not there, guys. We're not even close to being there. We haven't gotten to the point where society is broken down and is organizing for conflict. I mean, that would bother me if I saw, Americans coming together and organizing into, combat units, even if they didn't have guns, just to say, here, we have 500 guys here ready to fight. We have another 500 guys. Then I'd be worried. Right now, what I see is a lot of angry people. And they have sometimes they have a legitimate right to be angry. But I just think it's grossly irresponsible to be talking about us being on the brink of a civil war.
Ivan from Europe, somewhere in Europe. We're going to find you, Ivan. If what Prigozhin says in his interview 5 days ago is true, by the way, it might be more than 5 days ago at this point. We've been sitting on these questions for a while, but whatever, whenever he said it, what is your opinion on what is coming for the next couple of weeks on the battlefield in Ukraine?
Well, I'll say this. Prigozhin was engaged in information warfare. He was trying to make a point about the lack of support being provided by the Russian Ministry of Defense to the Wagner group. But there's people that have talked to me who say that this is not the reality of the situation. And these are people who would know. And that Wagner is committed to the Bakhmut fight. And apparently, this is according to Telegram channels, Vladimir Putin brought Prigozhin and the Minister of Defense Shoigu in together into his office and told him to cease and desist, stop this nonsense. He went through Shoigu and appointed Serovokin, General Armageddon, to be the direct contact between the Ministry of Defense and Wagner. Serovokin will provide Wagner with the resources necessary to carry out the fight. Wagner's not withdrawing from the battlefield. Wagner continues to attack. I think we're at the same situation that we are. This is a bloody meat grinder operation that Russia's winning. And I think the Ukrainians are, being bled out on the battlefield. But there's a lot of politics. I'll say that one of the things I'm discovering here is that if you think America's got some politics going on, Russia's got some politics going on too. So it's anybody who doesn't think that there's dissent in Russia, anybody who doesn't think that there's a multiplicity of opinions in Russia that are vocally expressed, you don't know Russia. This is not a dictatorship. This is not an authoritarian government. It is a time of war. So the government does have certain powers to intervene when they feel that the information war is being exploited improperly.
Talking about there's a lot of dissent. Have you found yourself, for example, in any pubs with ordinary Russians having spirited debates about issues of the day? Have you been in any situations like that?
I wouldn't say pubs because, again, Jeff, there's a real security problem here. I mean, there are people trying to kill people. The Ukrainians are assassinating Russians, and I'm on that list. So the idea of me going to a pub and sitting down and pulling up and having a debate, that unfortunately, that's not going to happen on this trip because there's a genuine security concern. But I have in within the I do these presentations, and there's some very lively questions and answer. I went to the Writers Union the other day, and these are supposed to be the elite, the gentleman that arm wrestled. He was the director of the Writers Union. And so I had
you crossed the picket line. You know, the writers are on strike here now. You crossed the picket line.
Well, I'm in Russia, so I think it's a different
picket. That's okay.
But I have to tell you that that question and answer period was very vibrant. I mean, it gets a little heated sometimes. No anger, no fighting, just the idea that everybody's going to fawn over me and, just say, oh, everything you say is great. No, they throw my words right back in my face and they challenge me. And we have a nice little give and take. I did a very interesting lunch in Novosibirsk with a group of bankers. And again, the questions were spirited and of a provocative nature. So, this isn't. And today I'm going to be speaking before a class of international relations students, and they've given me a heads up on some of the questions they're going to ask. This is going to be a nice discussion. This isn't, listen to Scott Ritter and accept everything Scott Ritter says. That's not how it works. These guys are actively doing the debate, dialogue, and discussion aspect that you and I talk about.
Yeah. Those are my three favorite words in that combination. And you're doing a book event also tonight?
I am. I'm going to go from getting destroyed by international relations students to a book event. All the book events have been I think there's a lot of frustration from people about the security issues. But what I like to point out to people is this: what price is it worth to have a book event? I mean, how many lives are you willing to lose? Because one bomb going off in a crowd of people, it's just not worth it. So the events, they publicize them, shortly before they occur. Usually the only people that get immediate notification are people that are trusted. There's heavy security at these events. And
well, let's take St. Petersburg for an example. We streamed that event, and that was a really good event, I thought. And it looked like it was in some kind of a bookstore or a hybrid of a bookstore that sells other things too. And they were showing some audience shots. Now, it wasn't the biggest venue in the world, but for what it was packed. There was standees as well as people
seated.
That's
how every single one of these events have been. You say there's other stuff. Go to Barnes & Noble's, and you'll see other stuff being sold too besides books.
Yeah.
The bookstore in St. Petersburg was a very nice bookstore, one of the older bookstores in the world. And the bookstore I was in Moscow was the biggest bookstore, one of the biggest bookstores in the world, a massive bookstore. Everybody understands that if they openly advertise this, that you could easily get 1,000 to 5,000 people to each event. But then
what do? They send out emails or social media notices to
literally, I literally don't know how it works.
I don't want to put you on the spot. I take it you're not going to say where tonight's event is because people are asking.
To be honest, I don't know.
You don't even know. Okay. All right. Well, that's a good reason not to reveal it. It kind of takes the decision right out of it. Mr. Anderson from Malmo, Sweden. Since he has no off-ramp and the end is near, could Zelensky be seeking Russian retaliation so he can declare himself dead and disappear with all the money he embezzled?
I mean, he could. That's one thing. I just don't think he's that clever. He's either going to run like a coward or die like a dog. That's his future. We'll see. Let me backtrack on that because again, the Russians. It's interesting to get things from a Russian perspective. Mm-hmm. And some Russians that I respect very much have said, about Zelensky. They say, regardless of what you think about him, understand that he is leading a country at war. You know, he is able to motivate soldiers to fight and die on the battlefield. And yeah, we see the videos of the kidnapping, and it's called mobilization, etc. We know that untrained Ukrainian soldiers go to the front, but there's a lot of very well-trained, very motivated Ukrainian soldiers, and not all of them are Nazis. They're people fighting for their country. And and Zelensky is their leader. And you can sit there and we can mock him all, and I'm one that's guilty of it all the time. I mock him a lot. But here we are more than a year into this conflict, and Zelensky is leading his country, and people are following him. There's political problems in Ukraine. Of course there are. There's political problems everywhere. There's political problems in Russia about this conflict. But say what you will about him, mock him all you want. He's there. Ukrainians are fighting, and you have to give him his due. This is a man who...
That's the thing about you. You're always very, you acknowledge tough competitors, regardless of other factors, favorable, disfavorable, whether you like them, don't like them. You always acknowledge a tough competitor.
He's leading the country in war, and the country hasn't surrendered yet, and it's fighting hard on the battlefield. So, he's doing something right.
All right. Nebojša Milunović from Leskovac, Serbia. Is there a possibility that the drone attack on the Kremlin was planned and organized by the CIA as part of a plan to cause the physical liquidation of Zelensky as a reaction of Russia to the, quote, assassination attempt on the president of the Russian Federation, and thereby gain the possibility of getting out of this conflict? People do have their theories.
Look, the CIA has been capable of planning and executing many plots that in the aftermath people would scratch their head and say, what the hell were they thinking when they did that? So that's a possibility. I think more likely, if you take a look at where the drone went, it was targeted to the dome of the Kremlin. I think they were trying to take out the Russian flag. I think it's a symbolic attack. This drone was not an assassination vessel. It didn't have a penetration warhead. This was purely an act of political terrorism, is what it was. It was a symbolic act designed to instill fear amongst the Russian people. But let me tell you this about the Russian people. They're concerned. I mean, there's no doubt they're not afraid. They're resolved. They're resolute. They don't have the same, USA, USA, USA kind of, approach to combat, because that's pretty shallow. I mean, to sit there on the street and shout USA, 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 and then go home, pop a beer and watch a football game, that's not patriotism. These are people that are just quietly resigned to the fact that they are in an existential conflict. And that they're going to win.
Weren't you glorifying that hoorah chanting at the Russian parade earlier in this very podcast? Wasn't that you?
Yeah, they were saying hoorah because they beat the Nazis, 75 years ago. The Victory Day is about defeating Nazis. Victory Day is about the victory over Nazis. And this is a nation that suffered 27 million people dead at the hands of the Nazis. Every family here lost a family member. And so the nation comes together in honor and recognition of the sacrifice that was made to defeat Nazi Germany. That's what people don't understand. Yes, it has become also an expression of Russian, will, national will, military strength, etc. But the Russians would have liked nothing more than to have a battalion of American troops marching alongside them, recognizing that we were allies during that conflict. It breaks their hearts that the West doesn't participate in this,
You sent me five different clips. You said you wanted people to hear it. I think I might know which clip is the one that has that. Should we play it and take a chance?
Sure.
All right, let's give it a shot.
Wrong
clip. Okay. You'll know it right away, yeah?
Yeah, you start with the soldiers.
Is that it?
No.
Okay. Three more. Is that it?
No, that's the missiles.
Two more.
Nope.
Oh, great. Well, I either don't have it at all or it's the very last one. Let me get, hang on a second here. Let me make turn up the volume. Is that it?
No.
I thought I got all of them.
Well, maybe I didn't send you it.
Oh, all right. Whatever.
That's a possibility too.
We tried. I tried.
Could be operator error on this end.
maybe. All right. Well, we gave it a shot. So let's move on to our next question from Senor Dylan Martinez, Argentina. I get nightmares after watching videos of defenseless Russians shooting with 7.62s, no bazookas, at Ukrainian tanks approaching soon after being butchered in the trenches. What's up with that? It says a lot.
You know, anybody who thinks that war is easy has never been to war. When we say that Russia's winning, Russia's prevailing, you know, that's a big picture look at it. But if you tighten, you know, if you tighten in on one part of the battlefield, you can get a photograph of a Ukrainian tank approaching a Russian trench with the Russian soldiers in the trench, fighting, you know, with light weapons because they've exhausted their ability to resist, and then they get killed. It's war. That happens. It's chaotic. You know, you can have all the nightmares you want. How about the nightmare of having 120 Ukrainian soldiers huddled against a wall in Bakhmut to have a 500-kilogram bomb level the building, killing them all at once? Do you have any nightmares about that? Do you have any nightmares about the Ukrainian vehicles running the gauntlet of death into the Bakhmut, rolling the dice every turn they make, dying? Do you have nightmares about that? Do you have nightmares about everybody that dies on the battlefield? Do you think this is easy? I mean, my God, man. War is hard. War is bloody. War is awful. It's a give and take. I just told you the Ukrainians are fighting like, you know, beasts. So, yeah, every once in a while, the Ukrainians gain the upper hand tactically. But you need to know the difference between a tactical action, an operational action, and a strategic action. The Russians are winning 9 out of every 10 tactical actions. That means 1 out of 10 times, Ukrainians are going to get a tactical advantage. And if they film it, it makes it look pretty bad. Death ain't easy, guys. Death ain't easy. If you're a soldier on the battlefield facing a tank or facing artillery or facing other infantry that have gained a tactical advantage on you, you tend to die. So, yeah, have all the nightmares you want about that scene. But that means that you're singularly focused on that scene and you don't give a damn about the rest of the war. I don't mean to.
Sky's on fire!
All right. This is the morning version of Scotty on Fire. John D. from Poland, Krakow, which I've seen spelled in various ways. That's how John D. spelled it. Please reveal the estimated losses of both sides of conflict. The Polish media are full of propaganda and Russophobia, so I doubt I would get any credible information from them, especially that they are starting to glorify the Azov battalion.
Look, there's reports that General Zaluzhny told Mark Miley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, back earlier this year, that the Ukrainians have suffered somewhere in the order of 270,000 dead, another 300,000 wounded. Since that time, the Bakhmut meat grinders probably chewed up another 50,000 Ukrainian dead. You can add another 10,000-15,000 Ukrainian dead elsewhere in the battlefield. So, you know, we're and then in that number with Mark Milley, we're you know, around 80,000 missing, I think, and you can assume of that 80,000 missing that around 60,000 of those are dead bodies abandoned on the battlefield that have yet to be recovered and acknowledged. So, you know, we're talking horrific numbers, over 320,000 Ukrainian dead. That's a huge number, by the way. And some people, including myself, are reflecting on that, wondering just how the hell that can happen, because that's a level of intensity that it's mind-boggling. You know, the Russians have, you know, the Russian military, the problem with calculating Russian casualties is, you know, when the Russian Ministry of Defense releases Ministry of Defense numbers, they're only talking about the Ministry of Defense. They're not talking about Wagner. They're not talking about other volunteer assassin or police units or the Chechens. So calculating Russian numbers is a little bit more difficult, but I think we could, you know, safely say when you calculate everything together that you're probably looking at around 40,000 dead Russians. That's a big number. And you're looking at another, 60,000 wounded Russians. So that's 100,000 Russian casualties. That's a big number. That's just a rough guess. I'm not here to, make anything official. I don't have official data, but, you asked me to do a rough guesstimate. There it is.
Okay. So we were kidding before you left for Russia that you might be losing your time slot because we have Tyler McConnell and Laurie Spencer debuting.
Not kidding anymore, right? I lost it.
Well, we were kidding about it, but look what we're going to be doing tomorrow night. Ask the Communist. Now, you could look at that as paying homage to you and me and the show we usually do, or you could look at it as maybe they're trying to usurp this asking the so-and-so question.
Oh, yeah. Tyler and I are going to have some words. Lori, I can never do. I can't get angry at a woman. But Tyler, bring it on, man. We're going to have arm wrestling.
Well, tomorrow night's guest is Caleb Maupin, and he and Tyler self-identify as communists. And I think this is a Lori Spencer idea to do Ask the Inspector tomorrow night. And maybe we can just get a little more info on that from Caleb and Tyler. Here are the commies.
Oh, God help us.
Indeed.
What's the show tomorrow night? Let's give it a good pitch so that the audience is hungering for it and they ask some good questions.
Well, I mean, I think it kind of sells itself in America. The political times, they are changing. And a lot of people just see that something is wrong with our economy, with our government. I was one of those people. I was progressively disappointed with American politics. And I found my good man, Caleb Maupin, here on a long, long, long search with Bernie Sanders failing me in and out. Obama failing me in and out. Everyone else failing me in and out. So, I think I'm a pretty normal guy. We'll see if I survive tomorrow or not. But if you hate communists, please join in. Give us your most brutal questions. Me and Caleb will be glad to take a stab at them.
All right, Caleb, you are an experienced podcaster, yet you've got half of the screen books instead of your body. What is up with that?
Oh, well, I guess I'll just have to move my webcam in closer.
Yeah, we want to see. We want to see you.
Oh, okay.
We're going to find out tomorrow night what it is to be a communist. Is that correct? You just proudly waltz around the U.S. calling yourself a communist, yeah?
Well, it's getting harder these days because nowadays when I tell people that I'm a communist, they think, I have pink hair and I'm obsessed with the transgender stuff and I think all Republicans are Nazis. And that's not me at all. I'm a communist in the sense that Zhuganov over in Russia is a communist, an Orthodox Christian who loves his country and is proud of the defeat of the Nazis. I'm a communist in the sense that, Albert Einstein was when he talked about how a planned economy would be better. I see things a little bit differently, and I think that the woke left is completely contrary to all of that, and that they're doing the exact opposite of what, people like me have been advocating for so long. We want to stop the wars. We're not championing more weapons to Ukraine. We're certainly not championing FBI raids and repression. So there you go. How's it going, Scott, by the way? How are things in Russia?
Things are good. I mean, speaking of the economy, Russia is the most heavily sanctioned nation in the world. And yet you wouldn't know it by being in Russia. I'm looking at cities that are economic engines full of vibrant research and development, economic development. There's more construction taking place in Ekaterinburg. I mean, the people who met us, we're apologizing, saying we apologize for the traffic jams, but the traffic jams exist because they're literally just this, they're on a construction boom. People are investing in Russia. I think the West is finding out that they're not the only game in town. And fact is, there's other people that do it better. You know, the Chinese are investing, the Indians are investing, everybody's investing. And the other thing you're finding out is a lot of people aren't leaving. You know, the people who are supposed to be leaving Russia have found innovative ways to stay in Russia, because Russia is a booming economy. The sanctions haven't hurt it. I mean, I think everybody acknowledges it was a shock when it happened, but Russia's recovered. Russia's doing well.
Wow. Well, there is a new economy emerging in this world, an economy that's about growth, not Wall Street derivative ripoff schemes. And it's that new economy centered around Russia and China and Venezuela and Nicaragua and Iran and so many countries that have broken out of this Western financial system, capitalism in its monopoly stage, imperialism. That is where I see the future. And I think the United States is eventually going to join this new economy. Most working people in the United States want their lives to get better. They want to see their incomes go up. So I'm real excited to come on this channel and talk about it tomorrow night. I really appreciate the invitation, and I'm ready to take some tough questions.
Yep.
All right. There he is. He's daring you, audience. He wants tough questions. Caleb's a great guest. We've had him on before, and I look forward to this tomorrow night. So thanks for stopping by. Let folks know what we have in store tomorrow night.
And, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Good luck, guys.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
All right. Take care.
See you, Scott.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Yep.
All right, Scott, you want to take a few live questions? Let's see. We're a little less than an hour. We've been at this. Not quite an hour yet. You got a few more minutes?
Sure.
All right. And why don't you get some live questions lined up? And hang on a second here.
Got it.
Okay, Ann, great. And we're saying bye to Tyler. There you go. Matt from Morristown, New Jersey. I once heard you explain away Prigozhin's insubordinate outbursts by suggesting they may be part of a larger intelligence game the Russians are playing. In light of his most recent comments in which he castigated Shoigu, is that still your position?
Yeah. It is, and it's based upon some pretty well-sourced information. I'm not going to get into details while I'm in Russia, but it's that. I mean, there's a real problem between Prigozhin and Shoigu. As I said, you don't get both those people summoned before the president of Russia to be chewed out if there wasn't a problem, but. Some of the things that Prigozhin said were definitely political theater, look where they are today. They're still fighting. It's what is today, the 11th or the 12th? 12th maybe.
Well, here it's the 11th. I think where you are, it's the 12th.
So it's the 12th. You know, he was supposed to abandon Bakhmut on the 10th. Wagner didn't abandon Bakhmut on the 10th. What's that tell you? They talked about having our ammunition starvation, but right after Putin summoned Shoigu and Prigozhin in, they firestormed the Ukrainian positions with incendiary ammunition. Artillery is still being brought to bear on the problem. So there's politics. Prigozhin was playing a political game, a political theater, but it's also designed to, I think, lure the Ukrainians into doubling down on Bakhmut under the perception that that somehow Wagner was defeated. So Wagner was going to retreat, and Ukraine sent some of their best units into Bakhmut, indicating that they may have fallen for the bait. And those people are dying right now in huge numbers. So. Sometimes the best theater has an element of reality to it. And there's definitely an element of reality in terms of the conflict between Shoigu and Prigozhin. But there's also, again, political theater taking place. And I think we're seeing that play out right now with the continued operation of the Bakhmut meat grinder.
All right. Let's go to a few live questions coming in on YouTube and Facebook from the legendary Ryan Milton. There he is. You want to look like him? Buy the t-shirt at scottrittermerch.com. Think about it. It takes a week or two usually to look like him once you have that t-shirt on. Scott, based on this trip so far, where should Americans go first when visiting Russia? He's no muscle-bound dummy. This guy's a thinker, too. He's got it all together. Good question.
Well, I mean, I think the city that would be most accommodating for people, of course, is the capital city of Moscow. It's an extraordinarily modern city, clean. The subway is just an unbelievable experience, especially if you're from New York and you've seen what our subways look like. And it's very modern, very Western. You know, it'd give you a chance to get a feel for Russian history, Russian culture. There's a lot of museums. There's a lot of art galleries, etc. But you know, it's also a misleading picture of Russia. And you know, if you think about it, the annual budget for Moscow in terms of investments, etc., is pretty much close to the same for all of Russia. So Moscow gets heavily invested in. There's 333, metro stations in Moscow. They're building, they're expanding the metro at a pace of, 10 stations a year. Metros are very expensive to build. In Ekaterinburg, I think they have 10 stations. So when you leave Moscow, the glitz and the glamour go away. I mean, St. Petersburg is like Moscow, big city, beautiful city, lots of history, a lot of culture, a lot of art. These are the two cities that would be the most receptive to people who don't speak the language, maybe don't have an appreciation of Russia. It would give you a chance to get acclimated to Russia, but you gotta leave these two cities. I mean, that's the beauty of what's going on here. Getting out into the rest of Russia and seeing just how wonderful this country is, how wonderful the people are, to understand, the local culture, the pride that people have from being from Ekaterinburg. These are people that know their history. They know how the city was founded. You know, Americans, rightfully so, love our history, love how our nation was founded. We talk about our explorers. We talk about, how we built this nation. And the Russians have the same story. And, this city that I'm in right now, Ekaterinburg, is part of that story, conceived by Peter the Great, expanded by Catherine the Great, Ekaterinburg, furthered by the Soviets. This is a major industrial hub. It's a major cultural hub. I'm meeting today with students from a society that's designed to prepare them for international relations. These are students that could be the future ambassadors of Russia here in Ekaterinburg. It's the fourth largest city in Russia. They like to consider themselves to be the third capital because they're competing with Novosibirsk head to head for development. And as I said, the economy is booming. Things are happening. People are working. Just to show you how strangely weird Russia is. I mean, I don't mean this in a bad way, but when you drive around the cities, you see cars parked on the side of the road, and you see these yellow scooters parked on the side of the road. And you can, let's just say, Jeff, you and I were walking through Ekaterinburg, and we said, and somebody texted us and said, "Hey, can you guys make it to dinner tonight?" And we're like, "Well, no, we can't because we're this way and all that." Well, what we can do is if we had our app, we can go up to one of these cars, type it in, car opens up, starts in, we drive, park near their house, park it, boom. We just rented a car for 10 minutes. And they're all over this place. They have yellow scooters. Kids are running around. And they're, if they want to go visit their friend, they just, on every street corner, there's a whole bunch of these yellow scooters. And you just, with your phone app, tap in, boom, get in, ride and drive off. No one steals these things. This society is...
let me ask you about the subway. You mentioned the subways there are a lot cleaner than in New York City, which is a high jump over a low hurdle. But what about crime? Are they... what sort of people are on the subways there, and are they safe?
Subways are terrific. I mean, they're very safe. The people that are on there are commuters. They're people who are commuting back and forth. There's no... you know, the idea, there's no homeless problem in Russia. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that there's no homeless. I'm not pretending that Russia is a utopia. I'm not going to go down that path. But what I am saying is, I'll tell you what, no matter what city you are in America, you will find the tents, you'll find the cardboard boxes, you will find the people huddled in the corners, et cetera. That doesn't exist here. It just doesn't exist here. You know, everybody has a constitutional right for a house. And
you know, there's a huge controversy. I don't know if you probably aren't keeping up on the news here, but there's a huge controversy in New York that's very reminiscent of the Bernie Goetz situation. You remember Bernie Goetz, right? So it was a Marine veteran who, and the reason I'm comparing it to Bernie Goetz, and I'm not the only one, a lot of people are comparing it to that, is because he perceived threat, but it wasn't all that explicit. So there's a question of whether or not he was overreacting. But a mentally disturbed homeless guy on the train was acting up, and a Marine veteran put him into a chokehold, and the guy died. And this is a huge Have you caught wind of this at all where you are? Oh, yeah.
No.
Yeah. So he hasn't been arrested so far, but there are demonstrations in New York, and people are jumping into the subway tracks and blocking trains. This is how they protest, because they want the guy arrested. So that's what's going on here.
Well, that's not happening here. I mean, look, there's problems in Russia. Of course, there's problems in Russia. They're, to say there's not violent crime in Russia is an absurdity. You can go on Telegram channels and see examples of violent crime. What I'll say is this, though. I've watched a couple clips of Russian police dealing with mentally disturbed people with knives. They don't shoot them. The Russian police run in there and they resolve the situation. They do their best to gain control of the situation without killing this person, then they take the person off to get the help they need. You know, if things I've watched, if this was an American police, they would have shot them on the spot.
Right. Well, now in this case, the story I'm talking about is a Marine veteran. He put the guy in a chokehold. Is part of the Marine training, does it tend to involve whether or not to use that kind of a hold or not, or is that not?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how old this Marine is. I don't know where he, you know, where he received his training. The current Marine martial arts training, the MCRAP, I think they call it, or something of that nature, has part of its the training escalation management, meaning that you use the old Marine training, which yours truly received, was, you know, 100% going for the kill. That's it. There's no, you know, there's no escalation management. And so the Marine Corps decided that that wasn't the best way to approach this issue. So they teach escalation management. They teach control. I mean, you're taught extreme violence if necessary, but you're also taught how to manage the situation. Whether or not
Yeah, because that's the crux of the matter of this controversy.
Marines don't teach chokeholds, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
Chokeholds are not part of...
I asked because this guy apparently was not intentionally trying to kill him. But the thing is, should he or should he have not known that this was a move that potentially could be lethal?
No, he wasn't trained on that move by the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps doesn't train chokeholds. That's not what combat's about. But you know, again, I'm not his lawyer. I'm not him. I don't know the situation he's in.
We were talking about this on one of our other podcasts last Sunday, Scenes from the Evolution, and some of the folks on your Telegram channel were commenting on it too. All right, let's get a couple more questions and then let Scott get to his day. What do you got, Ann? Thanks for the donation, Conda Strike. The Atlantic Council reported a one-tank-only parade. Were the Victory Day celebrations actually truncated this year?
Well, I mean, they're talking about the military hardware part of it. After the troops march by, they come by. The Russians came out with a T-34-85, which is a World War II tank. The crowd loved it. It's the tank that won the war for Russia. Then they followed it up with a reduced display of tactical combat vehicles, the Iskander missiles. They had a battalion's worth of Iskanders, and they had the S-300 missiles. And then they had the, I think it was the Yars mobile missile, and that was it. I think the feeling was that it would be inappropriate to display main battle tanks when you have a war going on. You know, a lot of people out there, that's proof that the Russians don't have any tanks. I think the proof that Russia has tanks is in Ukraine right now. Russia's at war. There's a lot of people that thought that it was inappropriate to have this parade to begin with. Why have a parade when troops are fighting and dying? But the parade is a celebration of the victory over Nazi Germany. And so the parade was held. They didn't have the Immortal Regiment march in Moscow because the idea of putting a million people in the streets was that's too juicy of a target for the Ukrainians. And as I said, the Ukrainians did send 3 drones against Moscow on May 9th. It was truncated. But I think people...
There was some controversy over whether or not it should happen, because to me, it's not at all like anything like hedonism or something. It seems to me like there's a certain... It's solemn, actually. Is that not the vibe there?
There's nothing solemn about this parade. It's a celebration. This parade is joy.
Well, maybe that's not right, but respectful. Is it not very respectful about what?
May 9th is nothing but respect to veterans, respect for the history of that conflict, and respect to the men and women who serve in the Russian armed forces. It's pure respect. But there was concern that there was a fireworks display on that night, a spectacular fireworks display. I actually got a sort of a front row seat to that on top of a high-rise building in Moscow. It was wonderful. And you know, families were on the roofs, entire families were on the roofs. This is what, to me, an American Independence Day celebration should be. People watching, but the kids were just, you know, they were crying out, you know, "Ura, ura, Dien Pobeda, you know, victory day, victory." This means something to everybody. The whole crowd was ecstatic, joyous. And that's why they did it, because I think they were proving that, you can celebrate Russian history. But there was also concern about the expense of the fireworks. This is a nation at war, and that was an expensive fireworks display. And there was some concern that some people might interpret as being the government being a little insensitive to the fact that troops are at war. But I think the overwhelming sentiment amongst the Russian people were, we're not going to let the Ukrainians or anybody interfere with our celebration of the glory of our ancestors. And that's what it's all about. These people continue to say, you know, my grandfather's looking down on me. You know, he died in the war. I can't disgrace him. I can't disgrace his memory. We have to celebrate him. It means so much to these people. I don't think Americans quite comprehend what it is. And I don't think, people need to also understand, in the West, they saluted Zelensky for renaming Victory Day Europe Day or something of that nature. The disgust that the Russians have for Zelensky over that act is palpable. I mean, he's a traitor. He's betrayed everything he stands for. I wish every American could be in Russia on Victory Day and see it firsthand and understand what it means to the Russian people. It's something that it's hard to put into words. You just have to see it yourself to believe it. The genuine, heartfelt, visceral love of their country and their history that the Russian people have. And like I said, I just wish we could do that. Our Independence Day has become, gathering around, having a picnic, popping a beer, playing games, watching a parade, and then that's it.
Cheeseburgers, medium rare.
Yeah, For the Russians, this is their soul. This is who they are. This defines them. And Independence Day should define Americans. It should be something where we have the same level of emotion, this visceral love of country. But instead, it's just become, a holiday, a picnic, and that's it.
Okay, Scott, I want to respect your time. Thanks for squeezing us in today. As far as the rest of the trip there goes, my assumption is we're just going to continue to play it by ear, right? We're not really in a position of scheduling anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big problems is the time difference, making sure, because when I'm available, sometimes it's not convenient for you. So, I will do my best as the schedule goes on to find to find a window of opportunity where we could do something like this again. I think it's value. I thought I was going to have more time to write while I'm here, but that just hasn't been the case either. So I apologize to people on Substack who are expecting articles, but it's just very difficult. There's just a tremendous amount of work being done here, and it's important work, and I'm glad to be doing it. So I'll catch up when I get home on the writing aspect of it.
Okay, I'm sure people understand. And the event you're doing tonight, we're going to probably have that up on our YouTube channel within a day. So folks, we've already shown two of your book events there. This would be the third one. So we are staying in touch. We're doing the best we can. And thanks to everybody for their support. Again, tomorrow night in the usual time slot, Strange Bedfellows. Tomorrow night, it's going to be Ask the Communist. And if you would like to submit your questions, you can do that at bedfellows.live, bedfellows.live. And you heard Caleb Maupin, and he wants difficult questions. So take him up on that. Same with Scott. Scott, you want the difficult questions too. No, these aren't softball questions.
No, they're bitch slapping questions, to paraphrase earlier.
All right. You take care, Scott. We'll talk to you soon. Take care, everybody. Thank you very much for your support. We appreciate it.